Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I am Julia Court. I'm the co-executive producer of NOVA, the PBS Science Series, which is produced right here in Boston at GBH. And I am here with three wonderful authors, two scientists, not just scientists, but quantum physicists, and a journalist who knows an awful lot about science. So, Kate, next to me, Kate Zernike is a reporter for the New York Times. She was on the team that won a 2002 Pulitzer for stories about Al-Qaeda before and after 9/11. And before going to the Times in 2000, she was here at the Boston Globe, where she broke the story of MIT's admission that it had discriminated against women on its faculty. And the story of how that happened is the subject of Kate's exceptional book, The Exceptions, Nancy Hopkins, MIT, and the Fight for Women in Science. Next to Kate, Shohini Ghosh is a quantum physicist and professor of physics and computer science at Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada. She's the founding director of the Laurier Center for Women in Science. Shohini's TED Talk on quantum physics has about 5 million views, so you should check that out. And Shohini is the author of the wondrously illuminating Her Space, Her Time, How Trailblazing Women Scientists Decoded the Hidden Universe. And Sola Mahfouz, it was born in Afghanistan and came to the U.S. in 2016 to go to college. She's currently a quantum computing researcher at Tufts University Quantum Information Group. And those two sentences sound very simple, but they're not. And how Sola did that is truly remarkable and the subject of the book she has written with Melena Kapoor, Defiant Dreams, The Journey of an Afghan Woman Who Risked Everything for Education. So welcome to you all, and thank you for being here. Reminder, all of these wonderful books are available for sale here, and Shohini, Sola, and Kate will all be doing book signings at the back of this room right after this talk. So please don't miss a chance for a signed copy with these wonderful authors. So all of these books tell stories about people who are driven to satisfy what I consider a fundamental human need, which is a hunger for knowledge and a driving curiosity about the universe, the world we live in, the life that has evolved here, and to find out at the deepest level how that all works. But these stories are also about the particular challenge that faced these people in their search for knowledge because they were women. All three books are very inspiring and uplifting, but they are also infuriating and upsetting. And I promise you, we are going to get to the uplifting and wonderful parts. But I do want to, before we get to that, I want to talk about the infuriating parts because they're really important. So, Shohini, I'm going to start with you. So, your book shines a light on the phenomenal accomplishments of particular women scientists over almost two centuries, starting really in the mid-1800s. And maybe two dozen incredible, something around there, incredible scientists. And I would guess that the majority of the people here have maybe heard of one of them, or the majority of, you're all very smart and knowledgeable, I'm sure, but maybe wider Americans and Canadians have maybe heard of one of these women scientists. Well, who do you think, who's a famous woman scientist?
Rosalind Franklin.
All right, smarty pants. Yes, she is. She's a very important women scientist, Rosalind Franklin. But probably the most famous woman scientist is Marie Curie, winner, first woman to win a Nobel Prize. So why is it, Shohini, that all these other incredible women have not been, who are in your book, we have many, many people have not heard of? And maybe pick an example of one and what they had to contend with.
Why, oh, why? That's exactly, I mean, it's actually a
now a well-studied phenomenon. It's so common that it's called the Matilda effect. And this is the effect that, you know, women who achieve, you know, amazing things in science, often their achievements either are discounted or they're attributed to somebody else who happened to be working on the same thing, but who happened to not be a woman. So I think that's part of, you know, this long cultural sort of bias around roles for men versus women. So that's still playing a part. And there's still this lack of acknowledgement and recognition and celebration of what women are doing. All the women in this book, there are, you know, specifically stories around, as you said, about 24 whose stories I go into more detail. But in fact, the book mentions hundreds of thousands of women who have worked in this field and have been behind amazing achievements like, you know, the Manhattan Project, the Apollo lunar program, and many other major, major achievements. So it's not just a few. There's a lot. Yeah. I guess to mention one who's, you know, an example of this is this one woman whose story stands out to me in this lunar program or the early days of the space program was this woman named Joyce Neighbors. And she was the first woman scientist, engineer actually, working for Wernher von Braun's team. And von Braun was a leader of the entire lunar program. His rockets were the ones that were eventually repurposed. He started designing those actually as missiles during the war. He was a German scientist.
Wernher von Braun.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he his missiles eventually were repurposed to become these the first early rockets that the U.S. NASA first started testing. And the very first such mission to launch anything into orbit. Forget about humans, that came late, but the first mission was called Explorer 1, and that required just a two-stage rocket because you have to first launch, and then you have a second-stage rocket which puts the satellite into orbit. That was Explorer 1 mission, and Joyce Neighbors was the one in charge of that second-stage calculation to make sure it was exactly right, because if it goes too early or too late, that's it. So she and her team, she led that team, and it was such an important success that she was specifically invited to sign the mission chart that's only reserved for von Braun and whoever was the most important person, which was her. So she did, but they said, don't sign your full name because a woman's name would undermine the chart. So she actually only signed her initials. That's the level of bias we're talking about. It's unfortunately still there.
And that, I mean, that's in the previous century, and going back, I mean, over and over again in your stories, the themes you see not getting jobs, I mean, that are just reserved for men in early on, they do not hire women in those positions, not getting paid as much as the men, not getting, then if they do get the job, not getting the resources, and then if they make a huge discovery, not getting the credit. So, Kate, in the exceptions, these are all issues that Nancy Hopkins and many of her colleagues at MIT and Harvard, two institutions right here in Boston, also contend with, not in the 1800s, but in the late 20th and early 21st century. One of the interesting things to me about the story you lay out with Nancy comes of it, she begins, you know, kind of her interest in biology, I think in 63. Yeah. So 60s, but through the late 60s and 70s, when we kind of think of like feminism, and the women's movement, equal rights, is really big, and Ivy League is becoming co-ed, and oh, wow, people say, oh, women have all these opportunities. But you tell a much more nuanced story about what is going on. So tell us about Nancy and her generation of scientists and what was going on at Harvard and MIT that she experienced and her colleagues.
Yeah, so Nancy, the story in my book starts with Nancy as a 19-year-old junior at Radcliffe, which was, of course, then where women who went to Harvard were enrolled. And she is struggling to figure out what to do with her life, and she goes to a one-hour lecture taught by James Watson 4 months after he and Francis Crick have won the Nobel Prize for decoding the structure of DNA. And in this one-hour lecture,
assisted by
Rosalind Franklin, of course. And so Nancy just falls in love with the idea of DNA, and she just, like, DNA is going to solve all the, you know, it's going to be the answer to all the problems she's always, you know, questions she's had of through her entire life. And she really is lucky. You know, Jim Watson adopts her as, you know, as a protege, just sort of anoints her a scientist, and insists that she get a PhD. So she gets her PhD, and the beginning of the book is really her struggling with, I want to do science, but I'm supposed to get married. And so she ends up being able to do both, and then her husband leaves her, and she gets a job at MIT. Just as two amazing things are happening, one, in terms of women, universities are hiring women and other marginalized groups, or traditionally marginalized groups, because of affirmative action, but also Nancy wants to study cancer, and it's the dawn of the war on Nixon's war on cancer. So it's really an amazing opportunity, and Nancy herself is not a feminist, she's not an activist, she thinks she doesn't want to deal with all these issues. And I think her generation, you know, and went back and I looked at her Radcliffe yearbook for the class of 1964. It's the last yearbook that's only Radcliffe, right? Because after that, it was all Harvard students. And these women are just so, they just think all the doors have been opened to them, all the problems have been solved. The men of Harvard who are going to become their husbands are going to appreciate them and all of their career ambitions, and they're going to be able to have children and have a career. And like, it's just like, what are you worried about, right? And Nancy feels the same way. And so, you know, people ask me sometimes, what was the hardest thing about writing this book? And one of the hardest things I will say is trying to figure out, like, at what point did Nancy, like, what, there's this chipping away. Like, I always say that, you know, the 20 years between when Nancy gets hired at MIT in 1973 and 1994, when she begins the work that becomes the MIT Report on Women, that was her schooling, right? Because somewhere in that period, she begins to think, like, wait a minute. She really goes out of her way to try to prove that this is not discrimination based on gender. But she ultimately, like, that's the conclusion she comes to. And the one moment that I really like to say is in 1980, which is the first year that the percentage of women on American college campuses outpaced the percentage of men. Now it's about 60% women, but at the time it was like 51% women. So you'd think, again, like, equality, doors open, fine. A male colleague of Nancy's comes to her and says, I'd like you to teach this course in genetics with me. And she's like, great, fantastic, prominent course, excited to do it. He goes to the department head and says, Hopkins and I are going to teach this course together. And the department head says, nope, can't happen. I know Nancy Hopkins is an excellent lecturer, but undergraduates will not accept scientific information from a woman at the front of a lecture hall. 1980, okay? And Nancy, rather than thinking this is an outrage and, you know, rushing to whatever, the president of the university and saying, how dare you, silently thinks, oh, thank God, he saved me from embarrassment. You know, I would have gotten these horrible teaching evaluations. Now, the truth is, I think even today, women are going to get worse teaching evaluations. They're going to be judged more harshly on teaching evaluations. But it really, I do think that this is kind of the final hurdle for women is, you know, we're so reluctant to trust women with, like, the really hard topics. Like, so in journalism, it's the really hard news stories, right? Like, okay, you can write the feature story, but are you going to write what we call the lead-all, which is, like, the big, important news of the day? Are you going to be a war correspondent, or are you going to write about fashion? And I think that was the case for Nancy. So it really was this small chipping away.
One of the big themes in all of your books, I think, is invisibility. Mm. And Sola, this idea of invisibility of women is so evident in your story. It's literal in Afghanistan. So can you talk about the place of women in Afghanistan and how the world you grew up in created obstacles for you and for the women in your life who wanted to learn?
Sure. So, you know, I was born at the time when Taliban were first time in power. At that time, you know, schools were closed for women. But then, you know, 2001, the U.S. invasion happened and the school reopened. And my family, my mom educated, my father educated. So, like, me and my sister, we enrolled in school. But then in around late 2006 and 2007, it became dangerous. I'm from Kandahar. And so it became dangerous for girls to go to school. So a group of men came to our door and threatened us, like, to stop going to school. And so I stopped going to school with my sister, but my brothers were going to school. And initially, I was happy to not go to school because I hated school. And Afghanistan, you know, at the time, you know, when the school reopened, you know, Afghanistan went through a very dark period of civil war and then the Taliban. And so all the educated people left the country, and the teachers that were there to teach themselves were not educated. And so they would beat the kids. So, you know, I was relieved. But my mom, of course, she was once a professor at Kabul University before the civil war. And she had these dreams for like this next generation of her kids are not going to be uneducated. And she would often say, you know, do you know how it feels for an educated mother to see her kids and daughters grow up uneducated? So, over time, over years, I began to, my brothers were going to school and they were thriving academically. And I became jealous of their lives because I could see, my brothers, older brothers, really intelligent, and it just, her life, his life, there was like the structure, he had to get up, wake up early in the morning, and the books that he always, so I felt like there's sacredness in his life that was kind of lacking in mine. And so I began to question, like, why is it the way it is? Like, it just, the obvious answer was because I'm a woman, and that's the answer. And generally, there was this accepted belief that women are stupid, and that's why the way they are. They're always like subordinated to men, and I could see, part of me accepted that idea because I would listen to my family, like the men in the family or like relatives. They would talk about politics and world issues, and obviously they were working, they had the money, and the women all talk about clothes and like those small things at that time that I considered. So part of me was like, maybe it's true, but my mom was a contradiction to that. My mom was eloquently spoke, like she would speak very eloquently and she was intelligent. So I was like, but my mom is not stupid, so that can't be true. And so, this was one of the reasons. And so I began teaching myself, and that was because, my grandfather was self-educated and he had like just daughters. And, in the society, it's like, if you just have daughters, you're considered kind of, you just have a lower status in society. And so he kind of took it against, like, I want to raise my daughter as if they're boys. And so inspired by this and his self-education journey, I began teaching myself, like started self-educating myself. And, it was not easy, but it's once I start, I think it's still like when I was teaching myself, there were times I would get stuck in things, and then I would feel like, oh, maybe it's because I'm a woman. Mm-hmm. And so the Defiant Dreams, one of the theme is about, self-education, but at the same time, kind of breaking out of this idea of, you're a woman and you can't do things.
Yeah, because that was the culture. And one thing I think is important for people to understand is that it was a difference where you were, it's not very different from Kabul. Mm-hmm. After the Americans invaded versus Kandahar, where you were, which was much more conservative through much of your childhood.
Yes. I think it's like, most of the time, I think the world, what they hear about is about stories from women in Kabul and other places where life become very liberated for women. But Kandahar, which, the Taliban kind of, it said it's the birthplace of the Taliban, and it kind of, the influence was still there. Even the U.S. Came in, the Taliban were still making its by the time 2006 and 2007, the suicide bombing exploding, and the place for women was shrinking.
But the theme is, all of these stories, women are told no. You can't do it, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. And all of it really stems from, even though this is happening at different levels and in different ways, it's all about disrespect for women's and disbelief about women's intelligence and their abilities. Kate, you write about a famous or infamous moment in the discussion of women in science in 2005, Larry Summers, the president of Harvard at the time, made some very controversial remarks about, in a seminar, about women's aptitude in math and science, and Nancy Hopkins was at that. seminar. Can you explain and remind people maybe
what happened? So the MIT report that on the status of women faculty came out in 1999, and that's the report that the women in my book produced. So this is now 6 years later, and there's the MIT report created great attention, really shone a light on the issue of women in science. So this was a conference at the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, specifically devoted to the question of, you know, how can we get more women at the highest levels of math and science? And Larry Summers came to give a speech, and he said, you know, he felt like he doesn't want to be conventional wisdom. He wants to be provocative. So he says that he thinks that he offers three reasons for why there aren't more women. The first, so, and Nancy's in the room, so it's like 16 people sitting around a table. One of them is Nancy. And Larry begins by saying, well, I think one of the problems is that women don't want to work 80-hour weeks. So that's the first thing that pisses Nancy off. And then he says,
she really is working 80 hours.
She is. She's working 80-hour weeks for decades. And then the next thing he says, and I think also, you know, if you look at math scores, women lack the intrinsic aptitude to do math and science at the highest levels. But what's so amazing, so I was going to make this the last, and I remember the story, you know, I've obviously had paid attention to it. And I was going to make this the last chapter of my book, and my book editor was like, let's end on a high note, right? So it's now the epilogue of the book.
What did you try to do?
So I wrote this whole chapter, and what was so amazing is I had to go back and I had forgotten the reaction to the story, right? Like, it wasn't, how dare Larry Summers say this? It was like, he's just asking the question. Like, and people blamed Nancy for trying to, you know, quash academic freedom. And the reality is, like, the things that Larry was saying, you know, he was trying to be provocative, right? Because that's sort of his stance. It's the way he goes through life. But this idea that women don't want to work 80-hour weeks, when I went back and researched the book, this was something that men were saying in the 1940s, you know, about female chemists and why there weren't more of them. And as for the idea of intrinsic aptitude, like, study after study after study has refuted this idea. But I just want to tie this to another point, which is that it's not just men who think this about women. It's women who think this about themselves. And that is the really damaging part of this.
Shohini, you write not just about these women in history, but about yourself and your own experience as a scientist. Are you seeing this in not only in your career, but the women around you, the women you teach and the women you work with?
Yes, there's the truth is there's still exactly those kinds of, you know, perhaps they're a little less openly said, depending on who you talk to, actually. But there's always, you know, some level of that bias. I mean, I was just describing to you how back in the early days when I first went to teach, first day of class as a professor, very excited, I walked in and one of the students said, oh, is the professor ill today? So those things of, you know, I guess these are implicit biases, so-called microaggressions, which are not micro at all. they leave their mark, and then we start questioning ourselves, just like we were discussing that, you know, it's women do choose to sort of self-select ourselves out of some of these kinds of perhaps bigger projects or particular opportunities that come along. Although there's also research that shows, you know, through surveys and so on, where there's been large studies to see how what men and women, everybody working, let's say in physics, think about their careers in terms of what are the resources they have access to, what is the work-life balance, how much time is spent on home care versus time for research, how quickly do they progress up the career ladder. And this is a self-reported data show that men do say they spend less time on home care and child care compared to what the women report. They have more access to resources compared to what the women report. They have faster tracks up the career ladder compared to what the women report. So this is actually current data. So it's still happening that even when it's, you know, there are structures and technically, there's obviously opportunities for women to apply for the grants and, you know, try to get that promotion and work on those big projects. Technically, yeah, the opportunities exist. But are we all playing on a level playing field? Not really. So we still have work to do.
Yeah. So why don't we turn to the inspiring part?
Phew.
In spite of all these obstacles, all these women... and you, so, do absolutely remarkable things. So Shohini, your entire book is really about these women doing these amazing things and what they were able to accomplish. Mind-blowing knowledge that they revealed about the universe and that had not only fundamental knowledge about the universe and why it is the way it is, but also directed society in a lot of ways. Can you talk about one or two scientists? Again, you mentioned the Apollo program, but others who have done things that we don't realize, but either have revealed the universe or directed, say, in atomic physics, like Biba or Vera Rubin. Yeah.
Absolutely. There's so many. So no matter what major physics and astronomy discovery you can think of, all of them actually have had women who contribute to it in major, major ways, whether you're talking about the Big Bang or the discovery of dark matter or what the universe is made up of or when it all started, all of it. All of those specific questions were answered actually by women, and we don't know their names. So for me personally, a couple of the women that really I personally admire and connect with, one of them is Cecilia Payne-Gaposchkin, who was actually based at Harvard. She was the first person to get a PhD in astronomy from Harvard University. Of course, at the time, she still got the Radcliffe degree. But she did her PhD work at the observatory. And the reason I love her story is because she was one of the first people to actually use the theory of quantum physics, which is what I work in now. She used that to try to understand what is the composition of stars. And that was in the early 1900s, and that's when, you know, even quantum theory itself was just being rolled out. People didn't really understand it. We still don't understand it very well, even today. It's just very confusing. But she actually was able to take this really strange theory and use it to figure out that all stars are made of mostly hydrogen and helium. And this was a huge surprise. Nobody really believed that.
What year are we talking about?
I'd say 1920s. So she did this work. In fact, her own committee, the members, the faculty members who were reviewing her PhD also didn't quite believe her. There was this very famous scientist at the time called Russell, who was the well-known sort of the person who was considered the expert. And he thought it was a really great thesis because of all the calculations. So he said that, but he's like, yeah, it's probably not true. So she was forced to write into her PhD that the finding is probably not correct. Yes, I know, infuriating.
And when she did get hired, her salary was listed. This goes to your. Her salary was listed under supplies.
Yeah,
so she's like, can we really put a woman on the paper
barrel? She didn't actually have an official faculty role, despite this huge, amazing PhD. She wrote a book about it, became very famous. She became quite well known in astronomy. Never got an official position at Harvard for like I think 20 years or more, but eventually she became the first. A woman to chair a department at Harvard. She became chair of astronomy, of course. So she's amazing because she had this impact on, you know, what we know about the universe, and she did it with quantum theory. She's still, by the way, not listed. When we read a history of quantum physics, she's still nowhere in that story. So that, to me, is one of those things that I hope will change, and also Biba.
I did think of one other infuriating thing that's just... is the mnemonic.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Oh,
you
yeah.
You just explain that.
Yeah, so, when I was first teaching in this course in astronomy, we were going through, things about the stars and their characteristics. And, if you are fans of Star Trek like me, you'll see often in the show when they go and find a new planet or a new star, they'll be like, this is a G-class star or, a category O and so on. These are actual categories of stars, right? And the categories are, it's kind of an odd sequence of letters. It used to go from A through M. And then there was this woman scientist named Annie Jump Cannon, who realized that the categories were in the wrong order, because she was very observant about exactly what each of the star sort of observations showed, and I go through all this in the book to explain what exactly how she figured it out. But she's like, yeah, it shouldn't be A through M; it should be O, B, A, F, G, K, M. that's the actual right pattern. And it turns out it has something to do with their temperature and eventually their composition and so on. So she figured that out. And that was, you know, what became the standard at classes. And that's what Star Trek, by the way, is referring to. So next time you hear that, you're like, oh, that's a woman's discovery. But, but you know, because it was this mixed up order, it was hard to remember. So if you open up any astronomy book today, you'll see those categories of OBA, FGKM, and there is a trick to learn it, and it's a little mnemonic, and the mnemonic is, "Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me."
All right,
so, let's not. If you have a better one, please let me know.
So, Kate, Nancy is also an extremely talented molecular biologist, did groundbreaking work in genetics. She also eventually realized what was going on and identified it as not right, and she did something about it. So can you talk about what Nancy did and how she actually worked with other women to eventually get MIT to say yes?
Yeah, so she did. So she is an extraordinary scientist, and one of the things about, I think one of the reasons that women, we don't hear more about women in science is because they don't want to raise their hand and be like, I'm being ignored, you know, like none of us do, right? You want to be recognized for your science. So she really did push for a long time thinking like science is a meritocracy, this will all work. And she just begins to realize that other, you know, the men are taking credit for her work. Finally, there's a big course that she's devoted a lot of her time to developing, and it's taken away from her, and she finds out it's these two men who are going to teach it actually want to start a company based on it, and she's on the outs. Anyway, so she, at this point, she finally thinks, like, okay, there's something wrong here, and she writes a letter to the president of MIT, and she's so out of, you know, university politics, she feels she has to explain to him, you know, I am a professor in the biology department, because he, of course, wouldn't know who she is, little old Nancy Hopkins. And a man who had been her boyfriend says to her, he's 20 years older, he says to her, I wouldn't send that letter to the president because he may think that you're just not a very good scientist and that you're complaining, whatever. So she shows it to another woman in the department who she doesn't know well, but she has tremendous respect for, because that woman was the first woman at MIT in the School of Science to be elected to the National Academy of Sciences, Mary Lou Pardue. So she and Nancy and Mary Lou go out to lunch, and they're sitting over this little table. And Nancy watches Mary Lou read the letter, and she's thinking, oh, my God, she's going to tell me that this is all me, and I'm a bad scientist. And Mary Lou finally looks up and says, I'd like to sign this letter, and I think we should go see the president, because I've long found that this is a problem for women in our department. So then Nancy says, oh, my God, like there's one more woman who feels the way I do. Maybe there are other women. And she says that to Mary Lou, and they think, well, we can't possibly survey all the women at MIT because there are so many of them, right? So they're like, okay, we'll start with the School of Science. So they go back to the biology department, and they consult a third biologist, and they pull down the course catalog to write down the names of all the women in science, in the School of Science. And that's when they figure out that in 1994, there are 197 men with tenure in the School of Science at MIT and 15 women. 197, 15, 1994. So they go out and they survey these women, and they ultimately, they pull in two more women who have cross appointments from the School of Engineering. And so they now have a pool of 17, and ultimately 16 of these women, including these first three, sign a letter. They decide to send a letter to the Dean of Science. And what's really interesting, because they want to start with him, they don't want to go over his head. And they write this letter, and they sort of catalog what they know, and they're so afraid about sending this letter, they think, they make an appointment to go see him, and they're walking over there. There's a scene in the book, they're walking over, they're like, oh God, surely he's alerted the university lawyers, and they go, oh, we're going to be in trouble for doing this, and they're meeting in secret because they're worried, like, women were going to be conspiring. Anyway, and they go to the Dean of Science, and they meet with him, and he's forgotten there's a meeting, he doesn't know what they're doing there, he hasn't read their letter, but in this room, he describes this as akin to one of his biggest scientific epiphanies. There are six women sitting around this table in the dean's conference room, and they each tell their story of their career at MIT. And hearing it the dean later says, you know, had I heard any one of these women's stories independently, I would have thought they were, and this goes to the book's title, I would have thought they were exceptional, right? In that it was due to the circumstance, or there's a personality conflict, maybe with a department head. He knew individually, he knew each of their problems individually, but seeing their problems collectively, he did what scientists do, which is recognize a pattern. And he thought, oh my God, we have a problem here. So all the women want is a committee to look at if there are discrepancies between men and women in the School of Science, and it turns out there are. And so they ultimately produce this report, it takes 5 years for this report to become public, but it becomes public for many, many different reasons. And there were a lot of things that had to conspire for this to happen. But ultimately, the woman who is the chair of the faculty happens to be an expert on workplace issues. And she says, we should produce this report for the whole MIT community. We should share it with the faculty. I get wind of this as a reporter at the Boston Globe. And the story, you know, we published a story on March 21st. It was a Sunday. And I didn't realize, my father was a scientist and had talked to me about the problems, he was a physicist, for women in physics. I didn't realize, and nor did the women at MIT, how big this story was going to be. So the dean of science shows up to his office the next morning after the Globe story has appeared, and CBS Evening News is there. Nancy picks up the phone. Radio Australia is on the line. Like, this was, there were women across the country and across the world who said, oh my God, this is my story, and I thought I was the only one who felt this way. So it turns out that all these women across the globe were like Nancy Hopkins, thinking that they were the exception.
Before we open things up for questions, which we will in just a couple of minutes, so I wanted to give you a chance to talk about, kind of, again, you mentioned a little bit about it, but your epiphany, and also you went through so much to, you know, not only teaching yourself, but then something that I think most people here take for granted, taking the SAT, you know, was a huge, huge ordeal. You had to leave the country. So much, you had to do so much, you had to sacrifice so much eventually to leave Afghanistan and to get your visa, say you were never coming back. Mm-hmm. What propelled you? What inspired you? What kept you going when you were facing all of these huge, huge obstacles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think I had so many questions, and it just felt like something, like I was in the dark, and I had to like find the answers, and like to see the light, and why is the things the way they are, and also just there's like all my life is like what's the meaning of life and all of that, and so for me the getting education and all of that, it just gave me that meaning. And if I was like, if I give up, there were so many times, I educated myself, but then the next step was to, if I want to go to university, how am I going to prove that? And the SAT, even that time, when the US was there, still was not available in Afghanistan. And so I had to go to Pakistan to take, and it was not an easy journey. It's, I've been known for a person who had like different phases. At one point in my life, I was like obsessed with fashion, and then I become religious really like for 3 months, and then I found education. It's like for like, the structure to my life. And so nobody really...
Well, you were a teenager.
Yes, I was a teenager, exactly. Yeah. So, my family, when I started educating myself, like my father was like, this is just another phase of her. So, just going to go away. And so, luckily my uncle was going to Pakistan, so I had to like lie to my parents that I'm going to come back in 10 days and take the test. And so I went with him to Pakistan, and turned out there was no seat available to take the SAT. And so I had to like wait like 3 months, and I took the SAT, and also I had to take the English exam, English proficiency exam, and I came back, and then I had to go to visa to apply for visa to come to the US. I got accepted to some universities in the US, but when I walked in, the visa officer just like in 1 minute just told me like not even looking at the the exam, like the scores, the SAT scores or the acceptance letter, and he just told me like, I don't think you're going there just to study, like you're an Afghan, you're just going to immigrate. And so I think that was like, even then it just felt like the just like the ground is like pulled from your like feet. And I was lucky, a New York Times reporter learned about me, and he wrote op-eds, and that's what allowed me to come to the US. And so, but then, all the questions, all the things that I had back in Afghanistan, it just never lifted me. And it just, those kept me going. And it, to this day, I'm now more of a writer than I do science, but I'm really, really focused also about, freedom, what freedom means, and like still questioning, like, what is the meaning of life, if there is one. And so, I'm like also working on a novel in Afghanistan, like set in Afghanistan. You mentioned about Al-Qaeda and things like that. So it's just like, the dynamics of 20 years of how those things. So yeah, it really is like from that, wherever I am today is from the problems and things that, I faced in Afghanistan.
Yeah,
It's an amazing story. We're going to open things up for questions. I have to ask if people can come up to the mic if you have questions, and you could line up there. No? Anyone? Yep, someone.
Here, here comes.
Great.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for this awesome talk. So in my life, I've noticed that when women, like when I do, but anyone, talks about achievements, the men in the room often feel the need to like one-up you or discount your achievements by being like, oh, well, I've done X, Y, or Z that's like more impressive, more prestigious, whatever. As successful women, how do you deal with that and not allow it to like get you down or feel make you feel inferior?
You're making a big assumption there. I'm curious to hear from you because you're in science.
I mean, oh my gosh. So, of course they get you down. Yeah. Of course they make you feel inferior. And I think this is, again, a well-studied syndrome, the imposter syndrome. It's always alive and well. So I think that the problem is often we ask this question to ourselves or to other women, mm-hmm. saying, how do we fix it? But we shouldn't have to fix it. It's not a fix the women approach that we should really be focused on. I think really it's the men we need to be talking to.
The whole concept of the imposter syndrome makes me crazy because it's like it was initially described in the early 80s and it was usually applied to women, and it was like, oh, you feel like you don't belong. Well, why do you think they feel like they don't belong? They've been told they don't belong. I mean, so it's I feel like it turns into a pathology, and mm-hmm. as you said, like then women are expected to cure it, you mm-hmm. know. So.
Absolutely. So I think the real cure is to actually address the reason behind it. And that has to do with how all of these preconceived notions of who should be heard, who is apparently smart or not, as you were talking about. So
it's, when I... Yeah, to be aware of the cultural influences and try to defy them as much as you can.
Yeah, and I really, speaking of imposter syndrome, which I actually also try to ignore as much as possible, today it's really helping because I also want to say, I mean, I know this is not a physics conference, but I was trying to think, have I ever been in a physics conference in a panel where there were two women of color who were both in quantum physics? And the answer is no. So today I feel like empowered. Thank you.
I have a daughter who is 26. She's a microbiologist at Harvard. And she has long, beautiful hair that she keeps very well. She has long nails. She has makeup on. And when she tells people she's a scientist, they're like, whoa. Yeah. And she's like, why should I change myself just because of what I do? And somebody commented to her, you know, you should sometimes go somewhere and talk to young girls so they can see you, that you can actually look like you and be a scientist. But then she's like, how do you do that? Do you have any suggestions how women in science could reach younger generations and how to go about that?
I mean, I would think, it's funny because I had this conversation or question from an audience recently at the Windsor School, which is a girls' school here in Boston, from a young woman who's studying physics at Harvard and had gone to Windsor. And I said to her, it's sort of like the Gloria Steinem line when she turns 40 and people say, oh, but you're so pretty, you don't look like you're 40. And she says, well, this is what 40 looks like, right? And now, of course, this is what 89 looks like, still going. But I said to this young woman, like, just keep saying, this is what a physicist looks like. So, but I raised that partly to say, like, she could go back to her high school and talk to girls there, or, you know, look for women in STEM club, or, you know, some way. I think there are probably a lot of avenues where she can change the narrative on that.
I bet there are lots of schools that would love to have her come and talk.
There's also actual t-shirts, by the way, which says, this is what a scientist looks like. Right. So right. Yeah, I encourage all women scientists to wear them. There's also this really interesting study where, you know, there's this famous thing called the Draw a Scientist Test.
Yeah.
Which students, you know, they're asked to draw scientists, and you can imagine what people draw. There's always wild hair, Einstein look, you know, white guy in a lab coat. But the study was that this
class was asked to draw the scientist, and it was what one would expect. And the teacher, after many weeks, invited a woman scientist into the classroom. These are young students, I think fourth or fifth grade students, invited a woman into the classroom, didn't talk about the draw scientist test or about gender or anything, just talked about her really cool science. And she deliberately wore this really multicolored jacket, so it wasn't a white science jacket at all. And, you know, the students enjoyed it. She left. And then many weeks after that, they did the draw scientist test again, and it completely changed the results. We will draw her, basically. So that's good news. It means we can change our minds. We're very easy to manipulate. So let's keep doing that. We can change things.
Yes, yeah.
Hi. This is a question for all of you, but also for Sola, because it's pretty explicit. You know, in your situation, women are like denied resources, denied opportunities to learn and to kind of get into science or, you know, like knowledge fields. And what, like, role, like, how, I'm interested in the self-learning process and just, like, how you found the resources. And I'm also interested in mentorship and also, like, what role that plays in, like, your experience and just in general in women in science, and also Salam Sola.
So the thing is, for me, my grandfather was self-taught. Mm-hmm. And so he had this, you know, I never met him, but, you know, his words reached me. And I think if I've met him, might not be, but, you know, he was just like this person that I was looking up to. And so he was self-taught, and he would say, you know, if you know English, it's like opening a window to the world. Or, like, don't tell me that you don't have a time. If you learn one word a day, it's 365 words a year. And that's, you know, it's better than nothing. So he had this, like, and he had saying, you know, I would only give up on learning if I'm, like, so, like, I have a fever that I'm delirious, or I'm coughing that I can't, like, read or anything. So, and then he didn't, you know, he was poor, and so he had to go get, if he saw white papers, he would, like, get it collected, even if it was in the trash. So, you know, for me, that was, like, if he can do it at that time, why can't I do it now? Because, you know, I had access, you know, he would listen to BBC on radio, and I had BBC TV. So I, compared to him, I had, like, more resources. And so I think, like, for me, it's, if he didn't exist, and he didn't, like, pursued self-education, I would never know it's even a possibility. And, you know, I found Khan Academy to ask, like, what resources I used. And so I used Khan Academy. That was, you know, I didn't, at age 16, I did not even know how to add and subtract. And it's like, I started with Khan Academy. And then, you know, when I came to the US, I had more, like, both male and female mentorship. And I think mentorship is great because, you know, you can go in so many directions, but someone who is already at the top in the field, they open you. And also, they trust you, also become really more intellectually confident because that person, you know where they are. And then if they trust you, what you're doing. So I think it just gives you more confidence to go more. And, yeah, so that's...
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Great.
Hi. My question is, what advice would you give to, like, bring awareness about sexism in the industry? Because I know when I, like, bring it up to other people, and especially men, I get a lot of, like, oh, I didn't think that. Like, I knew it was a problem, but I didn't know it happened here. Or, like, I knew it was a problem, but I never thought it would happen in my school. And so my question is, how would you kind of... go about, like, explaining that it does happen everywhere, and then kind of get them to back you up on it?
You could read these, suggest these, any of these books.
I mean, I think the reason that that Nancy was able to break through. I mean, there have been so many reports on the status of women faculty, you know, that were thrown in the trash heap, and the most important reason that it broke through was that they had the president of MIT saying, yes, this is a real problem. That was huge, but I always say, you know, none of this would have happened. Nancy wouldn't have done this on her own. She had to have the group, and none of the members of her group of 16 women would have done it on their own. But there is tremendous power in having a group, so that's part of it, I think, just to sort of make yourself feel like, you know, understand that you've understood the problem, that it really is a pattern you're seeing. And I also think you can just, I mean, you can just tell people that things happen. I think people are, you know, we're all so self-centered, right? People are astonished by, you just give them the most basic story. I think people do want to hear other stories. So I think, you know, maybe it's partly it's just not being too afraid to tell people. Again, as you said, it's sort of, you know, why should the women have to fix the problem? But I think we can educate other people about the problem. And it doesn't mean raising your hand every time you feel a small slight, but just trying to explain to people what the pattern looks like. And maybe I always say to people, you know, just conduct a small thought experiment on yourself. Again, going back to the idea of a woman, a female professor at the front of a lecture hall. When you see someone, say, on the news or, you know, speaking, like you see an expert, if this person were a man, would you listen to the information differently? Just suggest to people that they consider that small thought experiment. You know, if your doctor's a woman, are you taking the advice that she gives less seriously than you would if it were a male? And on. You can think of it in many different contexts.
I will put in plug for Nova and a film that we did called Picture a Scientist, which includes the Nancy Hopkins story and several other stories. I think it's a really powerful film, and I would really check it out. It's online, Picture a Scientist. But I think it gets at, particularly focused on America and women in science in America, and all these things you're talking about, it's not always overt.
Right.
You know, I think that's why it's so hard to name and so hard for people sometimes to recognize. But it's all these little things. It's not getting that extra 50 square feet of lab. It's not getting the microscope that you really, really need. It's not getting your name on the paper.
Not being included in the meeting where a big decision is made.
Not being heard in the meeting. Just all these little things that add up and delay women and is a pattern.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you. Before we end, I wanted to give you all a chance for final thoughts, but to talk about what we are missing, what we are losing when women are dealing with all the, because women are dealing with all of these obstructions. What is lost and what can be gained when women are a part of this enterprise of knowledge and science?
I mean, the thing is, like, you have different perspective and you're just like closing the door for yourself and like to, yeah. I mean, it's not just men, women are losing, it's just like both men and women are losing. And it's just,
yeah, the world. What is, yeah, the what world, is the world yeah, learn, yeah. losing? Yeah. Shoni, do you want to speak to that?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And it's not just about what we, all of us are losing, men and women, but also what science is losing. Because, I mean, literally without a woman there to notice, we wouldn't even have known about what the majority of the universe is made of, which is dark matter. So that's the level of loss to science. Because, of course, all of science happens when we, you know, progress in science happens when we realize what are, you know, the boundaries of our current thinking and think beyond that and find those new ideas. And for new ideas, of course, you need people from all backgrounds and communities. So, yeah, that's why what we're missing.
I have a better expression to say. It's just like looking at the world with one eye. You know, if you like.
That's right. So let's use both eyes.
Yes, exactly.
And all the senses.
All right. Did you want to add anything?
Well, I was just going to quote, you know, I always quote, so Bob Brown, who was most recently president of Boston University, but is a hero in the MIT story. And he had this line, he's very sort of plain-spoken Texan, and he said, I'm relying on science to solve my most complicated problems. Why would I want to shut out or even risk shutting out half the population when that's our enterprise? So that's how I like to, but two eyes, I like the two eyes.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Sola, Shohani, Kate. Thank you all for coming. They will all be at the back of the room to sign books for you. So please take advantage of that. And thank you so much for coming and being a part of the Boston Book Festival.